Hello, strangers. Flat Chat is back, and the latest GP racing is now on the newsstands. In fact, there's been another one since we last casted a pod. Oscar Wilde famously observed that punctuality is the thief of time. Our regular listener might suspect that there's been a thief of podcasts, or indeed that we perhaps were cancelled. That's cancelled as in Westworld, Crossroads, Neighbours, etc., rather than cancel as in J.K. Rowling, for instance. Anyway, yeah, we've had a few scheduling issues, with various members of our podcast cast either travelling or being struck incommunicado by unreliable Brazilian internet connections, not the sort of Brazilian you want to be having. And as a result of that, we've missed out on saying a proper thank you and goodbye to Matt Q, who has driven off into the sunset in his classic BMW. This is a bit like one of those TV shows where a regular cast member suddenly and randomly vanishes between seasons. It's not going to be like one of those TV shows where the same character is randomly played by a different actor, you know, like Miss Ellie in Dallas was played by someone else for two seasons. Anyway, I'm digressing. If you've got the latest mag, you'll have seen our new columnist already. He definitely doesn't own a classic BMW. Judging by his mise-en-scene on my little video here, he's got a much more squarely Kubrickian camera angle going on into his room, which is very good. Anyway, it's Alex Kalinorkas.
Oh, yes. Hello, Codders. Hello, Mark, being introduced shortly. And hello, listeners. Thank you for having me on the venerable Flat Chat podcast and also in the magazine, in the columnist section, Codders. I know big shoes to fill, very much so, from the very tall Matt Q. It'd be a bit odd if I was suddenly recast as him, much shorter and slightly less affable chap than he is. But thank you for having me on. No classic car for me to be driving, but at the wheel of the Flat Chat column and determined to give it a good go.
Question is, are you going to regret that beard in the same way that Matt Q regretted the nose ring that he was sporting when he submitted the picture for his portrait?
He really regretted that. Did he ever mention on the podcast how it ended up infected and he had all sorts of trouble? That was just after he started at Autosport. That was quite the impression to make. But it does need a bit of a trim. I don't know. I was having some sort of crisis with my other ridiculous hair choices of having long hair. And I decided against cutting it all off and instead grew a beard. More is apparently better.
Well, the thing is, more is always better until, you know, it starts disappearing, because I have a mate from school who always had long hair and it's starting to go a little bit thin on top. We're getting a
touch of the mid-fleet. Well, that's my day ruined. Thank you, Codders.
Sorry. Anyway, ensconced back in Adelaide after his voyage to the land of dysfunctional Wi-Fi, g'day, Cobber. It's Mark Gallagher.
Hi, Codders. Hi, Alex. It's nice to have you on board the podcast. And I do apologize. It really is, listeners, I have to tell you, my fault that we missed a podcast. And it was down to suboptimal Wi-Fi in my hotel in Sao Paulo, where I spent a very happy 36 hours, I think I was in Brazil, but I couldn't get the goddamn Wi-Fi to work. So that was a shame. But anyway, great to have the chance to work with you, Alex, a name that I know, and finally seeing you. And sorry that we don't have Matt with us anymore, because it was always a pleasure working with him. And can we say where he's gone to? Are we allowed to say where he's gone to? Or is that not allowed under data protection?
We can. I was going to mention that he's gone to basically tell hideous untruths in the name of flogging classic cars to people who've got more money than sense. But I wasn't actually going to say which of the many auction houses he'd gone to work for, or even suggest that that's what they were going to do business.
No, we'll just say it's a very upmarket, well-known British auction house. Shall we say that?
And we're going to stay busy mates with him forever because of it.
And we're going to stay best mates, because I think there'll be lots of champagne and canapé evenings, and he can invite us too in the future, hopefully.
Oh, it's going to be lovely, isn't it? So 36 hours in Sao Paulo, that's less time than it actually took you to get there, isn't it?
Yeah, it was 56 hours flying from Australia to get to. So if anybody doubts that, it's 13 hours from Adelaide to Doha. It's 15 hours from Doha to Sao Paulo, and I had to do that and back within that four-day period. Oh. So apparently it's very glamorous, although I am in serious trouble with myself and my entire family because my carbon footprint has gone up by a substantial amount as a result of that trip. So I do feel it would have been better conducted over Zoom, albeit the Wi-Fi wasn't very good on the other end, so that may not have worked.
That's
out
probably there. Why they got you there.
I think that's probably why they got me to come. They couldn't rely on a virtual engagement. But there we go. Anyway, so
quite
yes,
cold sweat inducing being in the air. If you're in a Boeing, particularly in a window seat, it's quite cold
watching
sweat inducing spending that much time in the air.
Yeah, watching.
Look,
watching
there's engine cowling.
Engine cowling, spare doors. Various other bits of. It's been a yeah. It was an Airbus, actually, that I was in, so I didn't have to worry about that.
Oh, well, perfect. My wife is actually down in the part of France where they make those as we speak. So it's been a boys' weekend in, as anyone who follows me on X, formerly known as Twitter, will have been observing the choice of evening viewing me and the cat. Anyway, let's crack on. Because, believe it or not, in a couple of weeks, it will be the 30th anniversary of that weekend in Imola. Alex was in very short trousers at the time. I was in slightly longer trousers. Mark was working in Formula One. In this month's GP Racing, we offer a different perspective on the lives of Ayrton Senna and Roland Ratzenberger. I figured that the events of the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix weekend have been pretty well documented from all angles, not least by us in previous anniversaries. So I thought I'd go for a more personal touch since Pat Simmons, Ayrton's first race engineer in F1, is our regular columnist when he's not firefighting criticism of the current F1 technical formula. So he talks about his experiences with Ayrton. We've got a piece on the Senna Foundation, which aims to transform the lives of young people in Brazil. And we also have a long interview with Damon Hill, Ayrton's teammate in 1994, performed in Australia by none other than Mark Gallagher. And of course, we never forget the other person who died that weekend, the Austrian journalist who knew Roland Ratzenberger best describes his unusual journey to Formula One, where he worked as a mechanic. There is I think Ayrton Senna saw in him a bit of a kindred spirit, and Gerhard, who wrote the piece for us, alluded to it, that everyone who gets to Formula One has to work very hard, and Ratzenberger had a late start. His family didn't approve of his career choices. They wanted him to become a lawyer or something. And so he ended up having to work as a mechanic and all that sort of thing to try and get his break. And even when he'd actually got to Japan and made it in sports cars and was earning good money, he didn't give up on his F1 dream and finally managed to make it. And, you know, Senna respected him for it and was very upset when he died and was going to actually had an Austrian flag in the cockpit of his Williams and was going to wave it after the race, but sadly didn't get to do it. So yeah, very, very tragic weekend. And as I allude in my editorial leader, British viewers didn't actually see the qualifying session where Ratzenberger lost his life because the BBC didn't show it at the time. There was snooker from the Crucible, horse racing, a war film on BBC Two. That all happened on the Saturday. So we sort of had a bit of a Murray Walker Precis on the Sunday. I sat down in front of the 14-inch portable in the corner of the room, perched on my university housemate's absolutely fetid-smelling bag of hockey goalkeeping kit. That's how we saw it unfold. Mark, where were you at the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix? Working for Jordan?
No, I wasn't. So I won't bore you with the reasons why I took a sabbatical from Jordan, but it had something to do with money. Because Eddie had none of it left at the end of 1991. So that glorious year with the 7-Up Jordan that everyone likes to talk about also left everyone involved pretty penniless at the end of it. So actually, I was working with, I was doing two things. I was working on the World Rally Championship with Ford, and I was working in Formula One with Keith Wiggins, who owned the Pacific Racing team, and we had Paul Belmondo and Bertrand Gachet driving for us. And Bertrand actually qualified for the San Marino Grand Prix. And I had a mixed weekend. So I was working in San Marino, but then I had to kind of hot foot it to Corsica, where the next round of the World Rally Championship was. And so I headed across to drove across to northern France to get the ferry to Corsica on the Saturday. So I was then told of what had happened by Keith Wiggins. And it was interesting because I'd listened to qualifying on Radio Monte Carlo, actually, driving along the coast of France. And when I got to the ferry terminal, I telephoned Keith, or Wiggy, as we called him, telephoned Wiggy and said, "So, how's Ayrton?" And he said, he's dead. I've just been told by Bernie." And that was definitely a moment not to forget for all the obvious reasons. And you know, again, everyone who engaged with Ayrton, whether you were a competitor or whether you worked in Formula One and simply observed him, you know, everyone had stories to tell. But if you take someone like Keith Wiggins, so Keith was actually, in an earlier part of his career, he was Ayrton's mechanic at Russian Green Racing. He was a mechanic at Russian Green Formula Ford 2000 before he set up Pacific Racing. So, and Ayrton had come and had a chat with Wiggy and myself 2 weeks before in AIDA. On the Friday morning, he came into our office and we'd had a bit of a chat. And again, it was to do with relationships. And Ayrton remembered Wiggy as one of his very good mechanics from his successful foray into Formula Ford. And that's something that comes across in Pat Simmons' piece about the personal relationships that Ayrton built with people around him. And, if you were good at what you did and he trusted you and you bought into what he was trying to achieve, you could do something quite special. So, you know, I never worked with him, but I did have that, pleasure of speaking to him a few times. Actually, say I never worked with him. I did host a couple of events with Marlboro when he was driving for Marlboro McLaren. But I think for everybody, it became such a seismic moment because the whole industry stopped and reflected on what happened that weekend. And when I did the interview with Damon Hill for the magazine, Damon reminded me a little bit in more detail about how seismic that event was, because we think of the safety in Formula One as being all about that weekend, but actually that weekend was only one part of the story, because then there was the Carl Wendlinger accident in Monaco 2 weeks later, and then there was the Andrea Montermini accident in the Simtech a couple of weeks later in Spain. So actually the Imola weekend kind of heralded in the most horrific way a nightmarish month for Formula One, which is what has led to 30 years of incredible improvements in safety, which means we shouldn't have had one further fatality, but we have had just the one further driver fatality in that time.
Yeah, and it's 10 years on nearly from Jules Bianchi's accident. Obviously, that was at the tail end of the year. Alex, you were in Japan. What was the sort of mood of reflection there? I know Charles Leclerc had a Bianchi liveried helmet. Was there sort of a sense of time passing? I know it was 10 years ago, it was at the other end of the year, and it was a grotty old day, and there was a lot of confusion with the light disappearing and no one knowing what was happening. Was there anything special done this year?
Yeah, there wasn't really from what I observed. I think obviously, as you mentioned, Codders, there was Charles Leclerc's wonderful tribute. I know Pierre Gasly and various other drivers spoke very eloquently on what they knew of Jules Bianchi personally. But no, it wasn't marked massively, I would say. There's just a nice tiny little memorial opposite the spot. It's not even like lots of things there. It just says Jules Bianchi, basically always remembered. And it's very simple. And it's just that track is a reminder of how brutal F1 really used to be, because it's so, I know it's the cliche, but it's so old school. I was lucky enough to walk around it. I'm currently suffering from a bit of a back injury, so I couldn't do our usual Thursday track runs that I know you're a big fan of, Codders, because you once comprehensively defeated me when we were in Miami 2 years ago.
I had the DRS on one of those vans, I think.
It just dropped me. It was fantastic on that back straight. Just walking around, you just get the sense of how sort of scarred the place is. Like, it's not pristine and perfect like FOM likes it to be, and I do think it's all the better for that, but you do understand how if you get things even slightly wrong at that particular corner, things can go wrong. And of course, as we're going to, I'm sure, come on to talk about later, Logan Sargeant had an accident there for Williams for very slight misjudgment. It is just absolutely, absolutely brutal. But yeah, thankfully, as Mark said, these things are not a regular occurrence, and F1 has made massive strides forward on safety.
I think it was that weekend in 1994 that really set off the state of constant vigilance, or instigated the approach of there having to be vigilance, because Formula One had become maybe a little bit complacent, I think. I say that as someone who was, you know, in their final year of university at the time, but the impression you get when speaking to people who were working in F1 at the time was that there was, if not complacency, there was a certain element, aspect of assuming that the job had been kind of done. And I know Max Mosley always venomously and viciously described his critics as talking about the worst sort of post hoc analysis, when they say that banning the driver aids made the cars unstable and contributed to the accident. But actually, in this case, I think that it may be a bit of post hoc analysis, but it was true. Damon has alluded in the past to the Williams of that year being unstable because it was originally designed around the driver aids providing a flat aerodynamic platform. Senna spun it several times, not least in the Brazilian Grand Prix before Imola. All the cars looked like a handful to drive because they'd been designed around this envelope of having a flat aero platform, which had been taken away by the lack of driver aids. So I do think that was a contributory factor. And I think Formula One now, certainly from my perspective, I mean, Mark, you've been around for a bit longer, seems to be a little bit more open to self-examination when matters like this arise. And it's certainly more data-driven rather than dogma-driven. You don't have people like Dennis Jenkinson around saying that drivers are just big girls' blouses because they complain about safety.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the Dennis Jenkinson comment about Jackie Stewart's, campaign for safety. Someone was asking me about that earlier today here in Australia during an interview, and they were asking about Jackie's contribution to Formula One. The interesting thing is that to the point I made earlier, I think in previous decades, fatal accidents in Formula One were seen in a very different way. First of all, they weren't live on television. They weren't in front of a huge audience. It generally didn't involve the driver leading the Grand Prix, an icon, the best of his generation for many people. So there were a number of things about the Senna fatality which elevated it, the discussion. There's often a question asked about, would the changes have been as profound if only, in inverted commas, Roland Ratzenberger had lost his life, relatively unknown driver, back of the grid car. I knew Roland far better than, as I say, I knew Ayrton, because Roland had done, for example, British Formula 3000, and I'd actually covered British Formula 3000 for Autosport. So we only had sort of four decent drivers in the championship, and he was one of them. So it was, but that was, from a personal point of view, much more sort of immediately shocking, the loss of him. But coming back to the point, the fact that in 1994, that double fatality had such an impact because of the media coverage, because of the live television pictures. I actually, it's funny, I only realized a few years ago I had never watched it. I know that seems incredible to say, but I had never consciously sat down and sought out that. Of course, I'd seen the clip, the very brief clip of the accident, but I'd never watched the aftermath and Murray Walker's commentary on that. And a lot of those images wouldn't be broadcast today. You know, it's one of the reasons we have this inbuilt delay in the live broadcast that you know, anyone listening, if you're paying for a live broadcasting, just bear in mind you're actually not getting it quite live, so, which is why the timing system is a little bit ahead on the Formula One app. But the reality is that it had a massive impact because of the media coverage and because the sport had become, I think, so much more professional. In, you know, it really through the late 1980s into the early 90s, the sport had really begun to shift up a gear. You know, the impact of all the changes that Bernie had made, the professionalism that teams like Williams and McLaren and Benetton were bringing to the sport, and then to lose this icon was exceptional. And when you look back again, talking to Damon Hill and him reflecting on the fact that Niki Lauda got involved, you know, in creating the GPDA. And, you know, that was triggered by the events of Imola. Damon talking to me about going to seek out Michael after the accident in Monaco and saying, you know, we've got to do something. You know, this is crazy what's going on. So there was a lot that meant that there was no mechanic, no engineer, no team principal, no driver, no sponsor, no member of the media. There was no one involved in the sport in 1994, who did not believe that we had to do something radical to change safety from being a nice to have to being a must have. And, you know, it's something, it's interesting when you talk to safety professionals, they'll often say to you that what changes safety in an industry is when the message comes top down as well as bottom up. So in other words, people at the workshop floor take it on board as well as the senior executives. So the fact that Max Mosley and Bernie got together and said, right, let's do this properly, but also the fact that every mechanic, every engineer, everyone was on board with the program. And that, I think, is really what led to the change, which has been profound. There are very few examples in the world of an industry where you had over 30 fatalities in, you know, nearly 40 fatalities in 45 years, and we've had one since. I mean, the change has been profound. The one thing that I will add on this conversation about it, and it is a grim subject because we're talking about the loss of two lives at that weekend. But the other aspect of the safety story in Formula One is that all too often, when we talk about the improvements that have been made, we have a tendency to forget that we've had three Marshall's fatalities in the last 30 years. You know, there was Mark Robinson, who was the volunteer marshal in Montreal, who lost his life in an accident involving a forklift truck after the Canadian Grand Prix in, I think it was 2013. Then my team, Jordan Grand Prix, we had an accident where both our cars collided in Monza. We lost Paolo Ghislamberti, who was a young married Italian Marshall, who's, I think his wife is pregnant at the time, and then Graham Beveridge, and here in Australia, who lost his life as a result of an accident involving Jacques Villeneuve's BAR. So, you know, we have had more than the driver fatalities in Formula One, but there's no question that here we are in 2024, and the picture is very different from what it used to be. And something that I, again, having worked in the industry for a while, something I'm very conscious of when I look at the content creators and the young media broadcasters who've got involved. There is now a generation of people involved in the industry who have never experienced a weekend like that. And I hope they never do experience a weekend like that. But it helps to emphasize the point that all those young men and women working in Formula One teams, those young engineers who now populate the sport, if they ever question why we do things the way we do them from a safety point of view, they need to be reminded that the risks have actually not gone away. It's just that we are so much better at managing those risks because of the strength of the cars. Obviously, the weight of the cars is often criticized, but there's a reason why the cars are as big and heavy as they are. And a lot of it has to do with driver safety. So it's a story that's going to run and run. Let's hope that it's many decades before anyone ever suffers that again. And let's hope perhaps it never happens, but we have to always be careful.
But that's a really interesting point you raised there, Mark. And it was something that struck me as I was reading Pat's feature, because as Cod has said, you know, in a strange way, because we find this obviously in my day job as it is on Autosport, how can you tell this story again? You know, it's the 30th anniversary. We're only 5 years on from the 25th anniversary. It's because for Autosport readers, for GP racing readers, it's a very familiar story. So you don't want to go over the same things, but also you want to be extremely respectful. But what struck me is just thinking about the gap between the 25th anniversary and the 30th anniversary is now this is the first time that the Drive to Survive Formula One fans potentially are going to come across this big sort of seismic moment in what changed the sport. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the reaction is, and also whether in a certain way it is important to go over the stuff that maybe your classic GP racing reader might already know, because people just fundamentally don't know how important that weekend was and how much it led to what we've got in terms of Formula One today. I was just trying to find on my phone as you were talking, Mark. I was in the Autosport archive because I'm an absolute nerd on Friday, looking for something that I'm going to do. It's linking the current Alpine team with the 1994 Benetton team. There is a link. Obviously, it's still the same team. It's under a different name, different ownership. But there was a piece in Autosport, I think it was Jenks again, talking about Eau Rouge was changed that year and sort of lamenting the fact that it had been sort of neutered by that chicane. But I'm very much of the position, because again, I think there's a link with the modern cars being so incredibly heavy and cumbersome, and a lot of that is down to the massive safety structures that are on them. And if a way that can be found to make them smaller and nimble and retain that core strength, absolutely fantastic. But if the price is that the cars just look a little bit slower trackside or on TV, for the fact that we don't have to have drivers potentially dying, that's really a risk worth taking. And I say that I can't remember ever not watching Formula One.
Yeah, it's interesting you said what you just said, because I was just thinking the other day to myself, can you imagine what would happen to the Netflix generation if one of the top current drivers were to lose their life while leading a Grand Prix, you know, live on television in that manner? It almost defies thinking about it. And yet that's what happened. And of course, now you have the whole social media interaction as well. Can you imagine how it would be handled and the reaction to it? It would be incredible. And so the world has changed in lots of ways. And I know we live in a time when the news headlines don't make for good reading, but one of the really positive things to have come out of Formula One is this safety journey. And it's something that Max Mosley, should be better remembered for. I mean, I think those of us, you know, the three of us, obviously being students of Formula One and of the industry, we know the contribution that he and his colleagues at the FIA made. But I mean, there's no question Max did something pretty amazing in the way that he helped to champion the cause of it and put together the resources and obviously had Bernie on board to make sure that happened. And it, you know, in the discussion that we have at the moment about the governing body and the governance of Formula One, one has to hope that whatever the FIA may be not particularly competent in, the one thing that they must ensure that they have total competence in is protecting the competitors and the spectators and the media, and ensuring that everyone goes home safely to their families at the end of the day. I think the closest we've come in modern times to witnessing something of that sort of severity was the Grosjean accident in Bahrain. And I think that's, again, for an older generation, it was reminiscent of those fiery accidents that used to be all too commonplace in the 1960s and 70s. But the fact that, you know, he literally stepped out of the car and into the arms of Dr. Ian Roberts, and yes, you know, he suffered a major injury to the back of his hands. But I mean, it was just incredible, and that was a testimony to the work that's been done since 1994. So it's fundamentally a fantastic story, really.
And also, Mark, just to go back to your point about the time delay on the broadcast, they didn't cut to the shots. They knew that it was happening and how bad it had been, and they stayed away until they realised that he was okay. And again, yeah. I mean, thankfully that had a happy ending, and that was immortalised in Drive to Survive. I remember being there in Bahrain. It was during the pandemic, so we couldn't get in the paddock. Yeah. But there was just the chill that you saw on people's faces in the garages, the drivers in the pit lane under the red flag. It was still there, even though we knew he'd got out of the car. And it just, it's just giving me shivers now just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Can I ask you both a question? Have either of you been at a race where a driver who, perhaps a driver you knew, lost their lives?
Not me. I was at Spa in 2018, 2019, when Antoine Hubert was killed. But I'd only encountered him once. I wouldn't count him as someone I knew as more than a nodding acquaintance. But Autosport's Formula 2 correspondent at the time was naturally very, very distressed by it because they were quite close. So it was that's the closest I've come to it. I was at Le Mans in 1999 when Peter Dumbreck flipped into the trees live on TV while I was in the GM hospitality sipping a glass of Chardonnay, I have to confess. And I very rapidly put it down, thought better get back to work. And it is astonishing how rapidly these things can happen and how fast a situation can change. And, you know, you can never be complacent. And I think maybe this is something that maybe the Netflix generation, the new generation of influencers and whatever, probably need to have someone put an arm around their shoulder and tell them the facts of life. Because Alex and I were at Monaco last year, trackside as we do, and I won't name and shame the individual concerned, but we were at the hairpin and this person was posing for pictures with their back to the track and leaning against the barrier. And to their credit, they did come to me later and say, "Do you think I should post that on Instagram?" And I said, "Well, if you want to keep me past, no. you've got a tabard which grants you trackside access, and you're just basically wasting that on a stupid picture. You know, you should never do that. Never lean against a barrier, and never turn your back to a live track session, because you don't know what's happening behind you." As someone else found out, there was a Le Mans 12 or 13 years ago where Alan McNish's Audi hit a Ferrari as it came out of the pit, and the Audi ended up flipping over the barrier and nearly collecting a photographer who was just minding their own business, wandering away, having abandoned their station about a minute earlier. And the next year, in the media guidelines that were given out to everyone with the press pass, there is a photo of the TV footage at the time, a still from that, with this person encircled in red, blithely walking away with their back to the track and this massive accident happening behind them. And it basically said, "Never do this. Don't be this person." The photographer was still there. They got their accreditation again.
Well, Cotters, can I say I'm delighted about that Monaco anecdote for only one reason. You've confused me and Matt Q. That was him last year in Monaco. So already off to an excellent start, fitting in seamlessly with the GP racing crowd.
Oh yes, sorry. It was you who accompanied me trackside. Yes, you were not the person leaning against the barrier, but Matt Q was the person with me. Dear, oh dear, anyone would think you were about a foot taller and had much shorter hair and drove a classic BMW. Anyway, let's move on. We'll come back to the now. Alex, your column this month tackles the issue of Williams and despite a very public disaster in Melbourne, you know, having to only race one car. And recently, just last week, some very snotty comments by raisin-phobic TV pundit Ralf Schumacher. The on-track performance is showing signs of improvement.
It is. You just have to really, really want to see it, because the what everybody I think forgets with the dullness of one team dominating at the front is the pack behind is so completely contracted. And that's a real problem for F1, because honestly, no one cares who finishes second. It's great if you're following it all the time, but the sort of surface level majority fans watching, it's a real problem. But actually, Williams has, if you dig into the times, I was specifically looking at the opening three races, the car is quicker on average, but it hasn't got any points when it did this time a year ago. And it basically, you have to have a perfect weekend if you're in that pack of back five teams and you're only really shooting for whatever Lance Stroll was left on the table in the Aston Martin from the front five cars. And so it's really hard for Williams. And I think they've made a really brave call in, they've stepped away from having a car design that only really works at Monza and Montreal and the tracks with long straights, to trying to have a more of an all-round car that's competitive on all different course types, which is what fundamentally the Red Bull does so excellently. But in doing that, it had a knock-on effect that they just had to change their processes and dedicate a lot of resources towards that. And at the same time, James Vowles, team principal, has come out and said that he discovered over the winter, or perhaps it was a little bit earlier in 2023, that Williams was tracking every single element of every part that it was going to produce to put on the car on one single Excel spreadsheet that ran to tens of thousands of pieces. And when you make the car more complex, So we're talking hundreds of thousands of parts, and how could you possibly do that on one document? The bigger teams, if you read, I think I'm right in saying you run a nod to Giles Richards, the Guardian's correspondent, his new book on talking to people behind the scenes in F1, and one of them is basically the McLaren sort of a garage technician spares logistics coordinator. I'm sorry, I'm just saying a lot of words because I can't remember the exact job title. But basically, what she explains very well, much more articulately than I am, is that the bigger teams produce digital car maps. So they know exactly what each part on each car is, where it's labeled, how many they've got, where it is in the production process. Williams didn't have that. It just had an Excel spreadsheet. So James Vowles has gone, whoa, that's not how we did it at Mercedes. That's going. But in order to put the new process in place, it just meant that sometimes they had too many parts or a surplus of parts they were going to need at some point and not enough of others. And so Williams was very late in bringing its car to testing, to getting it ready. And Alex Albon, his shunt in Melbourne exposed the fact that Williams just doesn't have enough parts to have a spare chassis. He's not alone in that. Alpine, we know, doesn't have a spare chassis at the moment, hoping to in the next few races. But yeah, it's essentially, this is what my column ends on, is that Vowles has gone, right, short-term pain for long-term gain. And he has to hope that pays off. But this insinuation from Ralf Schumacher that Doralton Capital are going to suddenly be feeling the pressure, it's got to be wider than Mark. They're a venture capital company that expect quick results, but did they see? They saw what he did last year, right? When he came in and suddenly the team was immediately much better run. So yeah, it's an unfortunate position that Williams finds itself in, but potentially it's looking at a happier place coming in the future. If it doesn't reach that, then of course you've got to ask a different question and say, were the methods correct? But right now it's hoping that it's on a sort of a better footing, as it were.
Yeah, it's a really interesting column. I think that one point I would make is that it does rather make us all reflect on the experience that Paddy Lowe had when he was technical director at Williams and got heavily criticised by people for the fact that the team was hopelessly uncompetitive. There was the famous or the infamous Netflix moment where Claire Williams walks into the garage and ignored Paddy. If Claire or Paddy are listening, you've both told me about that in at different times, and it's been it was interesting when Paddy was down in Australia last month. He was at the Adelaide Motorsport Festival, and I caught up with him, and he kind of mentioned that moment again, because I introduced him to Günther Steiner, and he was saying to Günther, "Oh, you're such a Netflix superstar." He said, "I'm known by everybody for being ignored by Claire Williams." So it's kind of quite a funny moment. But he, you know, the point I want to make is that Williams had clearly been behind the times in terms of modern production management techniques for some time. I mean, for listeners who aren't aware, you know, one of the big criticisms of Paddy Lowe was the lateness of the Williams cars, particularly at the beginning of the 2019 season, when they sort of missed pre-season testing. And that was all to do with delays in production. And, you know, to your point, Alex, by all accounts, the rather manual, outdated system that they had in place is something that perhaps was commonplace in the 1990s, but by the 2000s started to get out of date. I remember, you know, when I joined Cosworth in 2010, we had migrated across to what they call an ERP system. So listeners who would be familiar with SAP as a sponsor in Formula One, you might remember SAP on the side of the McLaren. They're now sponsors of the Mercedes Formula One team. SAP make the kind of software technologies are used in enterprise resource management and production systems. So essentially digitizing workflow across an organization so that you can see at any point in time where everything is. And in the same way that, you know, Formula One cars are digital and data driven, your production needs to be digital and data driven so that you can see exactly where everything is at this at any given point in time, see what the life of every component is, and to make sure from a workflow point of view that you're going to have the car built in time, that you'll have the correct spares in the right part of the world, the right place, at the right specification, all that kind of stuff. So it has been a publicly embarrassing situation for Williams. I watched James Vowell, one of his videos, where James Vowell was talking about it and saying, you know, it's completely unacceptable and we have to make sure this never happens again. But again, to your point, Alex, you know, they're determined to make sure that this doesn't reoccur, and they just have to go through the, they have to go through the pain. But it is pretty devastating when, you know, one thing that Formula One teams are incredibly proud of is that they don't miss deadlines and that they turn up for every race. And so when you have a driver like Logan Sargeant told, actually, we need to give your car to Alex and you're not going to race tomorrow, this is the foundation stone of competing in Formula One. You've got to be there. And if you're not there because you don't have all the parts, then that's a major failure at an organizational level.
Yeah, sort of back to the early 90s with teams like 40 and whatnot that could barely assemble one car, let alone two. Although, you know, this revelation from over the winter does add a little bit of perspective to our experience of the Netflix show, doesn't it? Because if memory serves, in that series where they cover the disastrous late arriving Williams, there's lots of footage of people sort of standing around drinking mugs of tea and kind of shrugging. Well, of course, now we know that actually they were just waiting for the Excel document to boot up because it was about 8 gigabytes. Or maybe not, who knows?
Yeah, I'd love to see, I would love to see the detail on that, because what one suspects that in some ways it's actually quite brilliant that you can get the whole of a Formula One car production into, you know, a series of Excel spreadsheets. I mean, I'd love to see what that is like in 2024. But anyway, I think that clearly they have to turn a new chapter. And in terms of the, you know, the Ralf Schumacher comments, no one outside of the company, and certainly no one outside of the senior leadership and the shareholders will know exactly what the ramifications are of this. But if we can go on the basis of everything we've seen from James Vowell so far and from Matthew Savage and James Matthews, you know, Matthew Savage and James Matthews being the two board directors for on the company, they're a pretty closely knit group, and they're going to have been pretty delighted with the performance of the team last year. It's been a step up. This year, you know, of course, it's what they're doing is not easy. As you say, Alex, it's so damn competitive out there. You know, you need to have everything come together perfectly. I love the fact that you've identified the Lance Stroll point scoring opportunity that exists. I'm actually wondering, do the other teams model their weekend against how do we beat Lance? Because that's our magic formula for getting into the top 10.
Well, surely Lance defeats himself.
It's so unfortunate. I mean, he's obviously, I'd love to know what you guys think. I mean, to me, he's, you know, competent racing driver. You know, he's had so much experience. You know, he can put in a pretty quick lap, you know, now and again. But at the end of the day, the very best in this business are so clearly on another level. And by the very best, I'm not just talking about Max and Lewis and Fernando. I'm talking about all, you know, there's quite a number of drivers who are on another level. And we've talked about this before, Colin, on the podcast, the point at which Lawrence Stroll and Lance Stroll, you know, sit down and go, actually, if we want the team to go on to the next level, we need to, you know, we need to have a couple of ringers in there. And, you know, and particularly now that Fernando has decided to stay until 2026, you know, what's the plan, you know, for moving it forward? I mean, Fernando's terrific. He's not going to get any faster. And, you know, got a new set of regulations coming over the horizon. And one would have thought that the team would want to have a driver ready to become the number one and take it on to the next level.
My observation of the Lance Stroll situation is that we know he's good. He won the Formula 3 title. He's stood on the Formula 1 podium. He's had pole positions. And yet there's so many elements of it that he just seems to detest. I mean, the talking to the media, one thing, the incident with his trainer after, you know, being dumped out of qualifying in Qatar, I think it was. It just seems to just be not enjoying it to put one particular interpretation on it. And then, yeah, I've got a memory of being in the Aston Martin hospitality at a Mike Crack post-race session in Las Vegas, you know, talking about the weekend, talking about what was going on, lots of season review chat. And you've got all this laughter going on in the background from one of the other tables, like absolute raucous laughter. And I was like, Mike, you're not going to step in there? What, like, you're the team boss here. What's going on? Turn around, it's Lance Stroll and his mates. And they're having a whale of a time. And I just think that for me, I could be completely wrong on this, and this might just be out there, you know, out on a limb thinking, but I genuinely don't think the Strolls view what's going on with Lance in Formula One the way everybody else does. For them, it is a completely different thing. He gets out of it what he wants to get out, which is this amazing life that he's got. He's the son of a billionaire. This is just what he does. And he enjoys various bits of it, and he doesn't other bits. But at the same time, we relentlessly on the outside are making this point that that's not how a team wins a world championship if that driver in particular is underperforming. So it's when are these two worlds going to collide? The reality that we think we can see as the media and the observers on the outside, and the reality that the Strollers are seeing. And you've got a sense that that point's got to come eventually.
Yeah. When worlds collide, is that a Bee Gees song? I'm going to have to Google it. It's rung a bell somewhere distantly. I'm going to have to send someone down. I'm going to send someone down for it. From someone who's patently not very happy in his work to someone who is. Elsewhere in this issue, we speak to Zhou Guanyu, ahead of the first Chinese Grand Prix since 2019, a man who's very excited by this prospect because he went to see the first one as a child, and it was that that fired his passion for F1. He became a Fernando Alonso fanboy. He's also made a lot of sacrifices to make his dream happen, like, for instance, moving to Sheffield at the age of 10 or 11, which must have been quite terrifying, discovering this world where summer doesn't exist but people wear shorts and t-shirts anyway. He says he loved living in Sheffield once he'd got used to the fact that it's the land of ever winter. And then to Maranello, and a very interesting journey. And we had a very nice lunch in the soup shop in London.
Right, Cutters, having read your feature and your interview with Joe Guanyu, not only is it, I'm dead keen to go, just off Leicester Square, apparently, to this, what looks like a very nice Chinese restaurant. My question, my first question is, who paid? Was this on GP Racing and our Motorsport Network expense account, or did Joe pick up the tab himself? You know me with the hard hitting journalism.
Dear, oh dear. Well, fortunately, I don't know if our finance director listens to this podcast, but let me assure you straight away that actually the team sponsors picked it up. Actually, I think their media handler Will was there, and he whisked off and stake or kick or whatever their whoever's front of house that week picked up the tap, which was very pleasing. The only thing I have to confess at this place, you're given little aprons in case, you know, as a Westerner, you have a shunt with the chopsticks or whatever, and the hot soup and stock, and in case it ends up all over you. And so I dutifully put this thing on, and after rattling off the first few images, Alistair, the photographer, said, Stuart, could you just take the apron off, because I'll not soft up this, you look ridiculous. Yeah. And so yeah, it was great fun. And yeah, and Joe chose everything. He was there with his iPad. Basically, they treated him like royalty, you know, like most restaurants that you'd go into, because it's not a posh place, it's a chain, but he clearly, you know, it's his favorite restaurant there, and they know who he is, and literally they rolled out the red carpet for us. We got there before they opened. It was a very wet day. They opened the doors, let Alistair set up in the little room. The little room is actually a private space that they have for events and birthdays and stuff. But they said, well, seeing as it's you, you can have it. It's fine. No problem. And yeah, absolutely lovely. When we photographed him outside, they insisted we take umbrellas from their rack. It's they're very, very hospitable and lovely food. Quite hot. When Alistair, the photographer, dipped his fork in, he wasn't one for the chopsticks. He had with his ladle had managed to bring up a vast quantity of very hot chilies, and Joe said, don't eat those. put them back in the bowl. Lovely bloke.
I was amazed to read somewhere last year, I think I was writing a piece about him, and I was amazed to read that when he was 13 years of age, he moved from Shanghai to Sheffield.
He was 11 or 12, and he'd had a toe in the water exercise when he was 10, like going over as a holiday to enter a race. So
I mean, I'm trying to imagine the degree of culture shock that came from moving from Shanghai to Sheffield when you are in still quite a formative stage of your life. It kind of reminds you that we don't feel sorry for these wealthy, successful Formula One drivers, but it does really take quite a lot of commitment when you're that age to move to the other side of the world to a completely different environment and then set out to pursue your career in karting when, you know, Formula One must look like a million miles away, and then to progress as he did steadily through. And I mean, he's really had quite the career, you know, part of the Formula One, Ferrari Academy, Alpine Academy, and progress. And he seems to have great spirit, you know, a really good personality.
He's very grounded. I think that's what that's my sort of takeaway from chatting to him, is that he's very reasonable, considering that, you know, if you're brought up in, you know, relatively well-off Shanghai family and things like that, and coming to the UK, and you know, he came with his mum. I think that there's a lot of racing drivers that come from very privileged backgrounds and are just complete nightmares, and he's not. Like he's very respectful, and I think that is and I think he's just very bright. I think, like, Cotter's, your piece talks about how, you know, when he was in F2, he had the opportunity because of the links to these academies that he was in. You know, he could have been on TV a lot more, or doing a lot more interviews or whatever. And he was just like, no, not yet. I need to prove myself a little bit more. And I think that sort of paid him back. But, you know, we're recording this ahead of the returning Chinese Grand Prix, and I honestly think it's a huge opportunity for him. You know, it's a sellout race. He can go to Sauber and Audi and say, look, I did that. You know, it's not the fact that there hasn't been a race here for 5 years and people might be quite keen to come and see what's changed in 5 years in Formula One. But actually, it's quite a handy moment for him, because we know that Audi is pretty desperate to sell a lot more cars in the Chinese market, particularly the electric vehicle market. So he's got a great opportunity. It's just, will Sauber let him show it with the pit stop problem we've been having early on? So yeah, I'm genuinely quite fascinated about Joe, because he's gone up against Valtteri Bottas, a driver who on occasion, well, on regular occasion, was able to beat Lewis Hamilton in qualifying, and yet Joe's shown pretty remarkably well against him, I would say.
Yeah, they're because they're not quite 50-50, but certainly in his rookie year, he wasn't defeated utterly by someone who's, generally speaking, a qualifying specialist. And certainly he's been undone in a couple of races where he qualified well by software glitches with the gearbox. So he's still a bit of an open book, I think. And despite what Antonio Giovinazzi, or as certain TV broadcasters insist on calling him, Joe Vinazzi, said when he got the gig, it's not a case of rich boy getting a gig and being a bit of a waste of space. I think he's very much part of F1's rich fabric. And it was basically what Bernie Eccleston wanted to achieve when he took Formula One to China 20 years ago. And the circuit was a very isolated structure on a patch of reclaimed land on the outskirts of Shanghai. Now it's in the middle of, you know, the beating heart of the Chinese motor industry. So certainly he's someone who should be part of Formula One's eventual integration with that market.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned the ticket sales, Alex. The tickets were sold out pretty rapidly. I was there at the first race in Shanghai in 2004, and it was well attended. I can't remember the exact attendance figures. It was well attended, but it wasn't sold out. And those early races, they struggled a little bit because Formula One, though it's interesting, Formula One, when it went to Shanghai, there was a sense that, you know, China needed Formula One. At least that's how a lot of people in Formula One saw it. They thought that all these big Chinese companies would become sponsors of Formula One and help Formula One through its post-tobacco phase in terms of sponsorship. Actually, it turned out to be the other way around. Western companies wanted to use Formula One being in China to sell themselves to the Chinese. So actually, it opened up the market. And, you know, whether it's automotive brands or whether it's luxury goods or technology companies, you know, you name it, the fact that Formula One has this platform there, and the fact that now in 2024, as you say, Cotter's, Bernie got his dream, Chinese driver, and you have the sport, you know, commercially on a very strong footing at the moment, and it's going to be a very healthy event. I think I'm right in saying that the contract is up fairly soon, unless you know differently. There was a contract renewed until 2025. I don't know if it's gone beyond that, but anyway, it certainly looks like it's going to be there for some time.
I think they let off Emilia Romagna with their year off that was enforced by the floods. So I suppose there was a uncontractual pause imposed by a pandemic. So I'm not sure if the details are public just yet, but you know, we'll find out. Everyone else seems to be on a decent length.
Yeah, just a quick bit of background googling there. It is indeed 2025, an extension announced in 21. But yeah, 2025, really not that far away now.
Next year. So incredible. Yeah.
Yes. Background Googling sounds like the sort of thing that would get you up in front of the HR department. But anyway, it is we are up against the barrier of time. Alex, I know you have a meeting to go to, which I'm sure will be wonderfully fascinating. Thank you very much. I think, Mark, you'll agree, very good debut here on the Flat Chat podcast.
I'd say I'm on borrowed time now. I mean, it's clear Alex is going to be a very firm favourite now for our listeners going forward. But no, great to work with you, Alex. And thanks, Cotters, as always, for hosting our one-hour chat about the latest edition of GP Racing.
You're both far too kind. But yes, thank you very much. I'm sure shambolic service will be established soon enough, I'm sure.
Have you been reading your reviews? Well, you know, Mark, you are in the home of same character, different actor. Because, you know, Australia, Neighbours, were there three different actresses who played Lucy Robinson? Anyway, I am definitely digressing.
Literally, haven't they brought Neighbours back?
Yes, they have brought Neighbours back. Jeff Bezos, I think, is responsible for that one. Anyway, it is time, yeah, before everyone's chariot turns into a pumpkin, we must sign off. If you don't yet subscribe to GP Racing, head to gpracing.com, where print and digital and auto sport plus packages start at 3 issues for £3. What a bargain. If you prefer to walk to the shops, visit seymour.co.uk, type your postcode into the store finder to locate your nearest stockist. That's Seymour spelled as in Seymour de Campus, the Golden Eagle mascot of the University of Southern Mississippi sports teams. Thank you. We'll see you next month. This has been a Motorsport Network Media production. The producer was Dre Harrison.